This is the Technology Advisory Professionals Technology Innovation and Growth Podcast, hosted by Sean Gancharis. This podcast is dedicated to supporting business leaders and entrepreneurs in choosing technology, finding innovation, and achieving growth. Enjoy this week's episode. Today's episode is The Awkward Teen Growth Phase. I'm Sean Gancharis, and we're joined today by two successful and intelligent business people in Dave Bodnarchuk and Karen Brookman. Dave is an FCPA, FCA, and an entrepreneur from Edmonton who started his journey at the University of Alberta. He has worked with Apple, KPMG, and Oracle. He is a mentor to many. He has built and sold a number of technology businesses. The only thing now is to get him in flame silks. Karen, a Calgarian who took her skills to Toronto, became a successful entrepreneur, built and sold a technology company, then went on to a leadership role at Ricoh, a major global corporation, and has now returned to Calgary as president and CEO of West Canadian Digital Imaging, and we're happy to have her back.
Thanks,
Good afternoon, you two. How are you today?
Good, really good.
Yeah, we're doing great. Getting through it.
Excellent. In this enclosed time. In this episode, we're looking at what I personally call the awkward teen growth phase. To explain a little bit about what I mean is, many companies get to a growth stage where what has made them initially successful is not showing the same results due to growth, and they need to do something different. And some companies do, and some companies don't manage that so well. And it's really my premise is that it's really individual. So, Karen, perhaps you can speak to growing to that point, and if you had a struggle getting over that hump.
Sure. Well, I think the example that comes to mind for me, I think, is my first business, which was a company called Commonwealth Legal. And we really took that company from zero to a multi-million dollar company across the country. And, you know, the early stage, you know, I think your question is what changes. The early stage, you know, is very experimental. It's very unstructured. It's very entrepreneurial. And I think, you know, during those early stages, I mean, we're struggling to make revenue. We're trying to figure out if the business model is going to work. And then things start to work and start to happen. And I think the way that I think about it is that as you start to gain momentum and start to put in the building blocks, you hit a moment. And for me, it was, you know, there's sort of milestones, like it's around $5 million and then $10 million as sort of these milestones where something else is needed. And it may be people, it may be infrastructure, it may be process, but you need something that will help you scale, because what got you from point A to point B is often not scalable. I think that's where I would start.
Right, right. And Dave, you've been through this a couple of times. In your view, what's kind of the most critical to get through it? Is it, you know, bringing in additional leadership? Is it looking at pursuing more structured funding? Or,
well, I've never, you know, from my perspective, we don't look at the outside funding. I'm an accountant by trade, right? So I've always bootstrapped our businesses, and you know, certainly it's around the people and putting in enough infrastructure, but more it's recognizing, for me, it's recognizing the moment. And then, you know, alluding to what Karen had talked about, you can go back and do things one way, but that will only get you so far. But if you recognize that the right time to pivot, and sometimes it can be external factors that just force you to make changes. You know, in one case with the financial services crisis, I was running a business around software that helped out with ticketing and registration. And with financial, a lot of our customers were in the US. We had a fair chunk of folks that were using it, but in 2008 with the financial services crisis, you know, 65% of the market went away. So we pivoted to schools, and then we did that pivot on the basis of some previous learnings, added some specific pieces of function, and then focused on, made them, our moment was focusing on that school so we could really grow that and get into a cyclical kind of business. And then everybody was galvanized around it so we could grow that way. And it was good for us, for sure.
Right. Right. You know, both you come from different areas, and you, Dave, you kind of bring up the doing business with the US. I guess that's an interesting thing that I'd like to ask about. Karen, you started your journey in Toronto, really. And Dave, you've got a lot of business with the US. You find there's geographical differences to those type of things. Does that complicate that growth, or is that just part of your pivot where you're like, well, I have to change geographies? You know, Karen, you can go first.
Sure, I'll answer that. I think, so in our business, we've always had very strong relationships in the US. Having said that, in general, the partnerships were about bringing something cross-border. So bringing a technology into Canada, developing a partnership where we could fulfill something in Canada or service the Canadian market. We haven't done a lot yet in terms of actually opening an office in the US. It is something that we would like to do, and I think like to do in the near future. But I do think, you know, as we deal with American companies, there are cultural differences, there are market differences. In the case of the legal market that we were in, it's a completely different legal system. And I think one thing I would say, even from the partnerships we've had, is don't underestimate the differences. I think you really have to do your homework.
Right. Right. Excuse me. Sorry. So when companies reach this tipping point and this whole size, and Karen, you kind of alluded to it, is there a milestone that entrepreneurs can look for? Is there something they can go, you know what, maybe I'm here. Is that a revenue figure? You know, is that, I don't know.
I think it's when things start to break.
Yes.
That's great. If you go through and you're seeing, you know, you're starting to get some scalability. There's a number of really great books on that. I'm kind of one of those, as one of the guys in my forum talked about, I'm one of those business book nerds kind of thing, because the older I get, the more I don't know. That's the long and the short of it. But certainly from the perspective of employee size makes a big role. You're not going to be the same company when you're under 10 versus under 25 versus under 250. And those are good thresholds. The second one is, to me, it's not so much revenue, but it's delivery. So your ability to deliver and still service the customer is very different than when you're under 10 and you're trying to figure out how to service that customer versus, you know, getting into that real growth phase that says, look, we're starting to put process in place. You know, even today, I've got one team member that is fantastic at delivering the service to the customer. But the question is how does she scale that fantastic capability so that we can get another 10 people being able to do that service? So I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, I think it does. I mean, Greg, you know, doing something at one level, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that you can do it at the next level, or you can iterate that out to a number of different sizes. I mean, as you had suggested, you know, having one person who can do that role really well does not guarantee that you can create 15 or 20 of those people who can continue to do that role really well. It's just something to think about.
You know, just to build on what Dave was saying, I think one of the things that is surprising, and I think about kind of the first five years, you know, and there's all sorts of benchmarks. You could say, you know, 5 million revenue, first 5 years, so many, you know, number of employees, there's all these different sort of milestones. But the thing that surprised me is that, and in this umbrella of it starts to break, is that often you are growing too quickly, or there's more opportunity than you can handle. And that's surprising, right? And because you think, well, if I'm not going to make it, it's because I'm not going to have enough opportunity. And actually, it's because often we have too much. And so then it kind of calls into question, you know, where are we going? What's the focus of this business? What can we do really well? And for me, there's kind of, you know, as you talk about the awkward teenager, there's kind of a growing up moment where you say, we can't operate this way anymore. We have to start making some choices. We have to start being a bit more strategic. We have to be able to say no to some business, which is the hardest thing, because when you're in a startup, you're literally like, you have business? Yes, we'll do it. Just to keep the lights on. And so I think those early stages are really, they're exhilarating and they're so tough. And I think the sooner you get to that moment of, okay, we've got something that's working, you know, now we can really start to make the choices about the future, you know, for better in some ways.
It's a really good point, right? Like we use the term internally as, what are we going to be the best in the world at? And if you decide that you are going to be the best in the world, you know, in the old business, you know, prior to the divestiture in 2018, we decided that we were going to be the best in the world at catering for, we were going to do graduations and we were going to cater to grad tickets and we were going to be the best in the world at that. That's all we were going to do. And the team started to say, okay, if this is what we're going to be best in the world at, it gives the team the capability to say no to things because there was no thing. And then once you become the best in the world at something or you really get that reputation, those customers will come back to you and say, well, you guys are so good at this. What about this? And they'll define different opportunities for you, right? That's number one. The second one is when you're not the best in the world at something, people tend not to tell you. Right. That's just the way, and that's been my experience. And I know the stuff. But when you do something real well, they'll say, yeah, it's really good. And let's do one more thing. And I come from a technology bent in terms of software delivery on that basis. So that's guided us really well. Like it's really worked for us. And when you combine that with a really strong core set of values, and it's an overused term, but for us, it really makes the difference because then people will start to make good decisions when you're not there. It's kind of like your folks, you know, at the end of the day, they've raised you right. They've done some good things, you know, and because they want you to be able to have a tool set to make good decisions. We do the same thing in our company with our core values. Today it's the E-team, and that's about elections. It's about ethics. It's about tenacity. It's about, you know, certainly from an empathy perspective, making sure we understand our customers, awesome sauce and motivation. And if you give those kinds of things, folks will make good decisions after the fact. So that when you get to those different growth stages, they're figuring out how to replicate themselves because they're trying to find like-minded people to do that too.
Right. Right. Yeah. And you touched on something that I was thinking before you had said it, and that, you know, it's always useful practice to go through saying your mission, vision, and values. But I find that some companies, once they start in this crazy growth phase, that kind of just goes out the window. We forget about those mission, vision, and values. And it's really critical that you would, you know, from a guy who hasn't done this at your level, it's really critical to adhere to that. You know, what were we trying to do and what is important to us type of thing, and not fall down the rabbit hole of, hey, you did A really well, so why don't you do X? And that, you know, just doesn't work out so well.
Yeah.
Are there good support tools for companies at that size? Like, or are you kind of on your own?
I think there's a lot of good support tools. I mean, you know, first of all, and it sounds like Dave, I suspect he and I have probably crossed paths in different organizations, but first of all, as a leader, so I'd start there. I would say as a leader, like, you know, I pretty early on in my career, I got involved with EO or YEO, it used to be the Entrepreneurs Organization.
Yep.
So getting involved in organizations that support entrepreneurialism or startups and start to help create your network, I think is critical. You know, you need those support systems. You need that expertise, and your network will carry you so far through thick and thin. The other one I would share is we got signed up to, I guess you could say, the Gazelles model that was developed by Vern Harnish, and we actually work with a company still out of Ontario called the Entrepreneurial Engine. And they helped bring in these very agile strategic planning processes and systems and performance management tools so that we could put discipline in place and keep us on track and get us focused, but not in a tedious, onerous way. And that has been a godsend. I think that's one of the secrets to our success over many years.
Yeah, okay. I'll echo that. I chuckled when Karen talked about the Gazelles. My journey was a little bit different in that from an EO perspective, I wanted to be around technology folks, like software as a service businesses. So I sought out, I had a good friend in Vancouver said, well, you know, I know you're looking for something, you can do it. And he said, why don't you think about our roundtable? It was through Ace Tech. And what was very interesting is there was a lady by the name, Ace Tech had something in addition to the peer piece, like EO does and does a great job with. They did a growth thing, and they followed Vern Hattersh's thing through a book called Scaling Up. And there's a lady by the name of Shannon Susko that did that with a number of technology companies. And for me, that was great because I could look at her and say, you've done exactly what I want to do. And everybody in my round table was focused on that same thing. And it, you know, I credit those guys and gals with being able to help me exit, right? Like that thing, the moment, because it defined focus. It said, look, these are some strategic directions. We were going through some of the same issues. And you know, those folks, like our round table disbanded, right? Because we had all gone to different places, but they're still great friends and they're good people. And I give them a ton of credit for, if I've had any success, the only thing that I know is you can't do it by yourself. And those guys and gals deserve a ton of credit, as well as the Ace Tech folks. It's a fantastic program.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that from an entrepreneurial, and I don't know if this is similar because I'm not 100% familiar with Ace Tech, but there are programs now like the Creative Destruction Lab, which is similar type of thing, although more focused on the 10X market down south, obviously. And it's a little bit more about achieving funding and not as much about building a company as much as, you know, getting an idea south. But still, it's a network if that's the path you want to choose, I guess.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with CDL, Sean. I sit on of something called the A100, and those are tech guys that have subsequently exited, want to help the next generation of entrepreneurs. So we talk about CDL. There's something called eHub and Rural eHub at the U of A. There's lots, you know, many different incubators called Y Combinator on the tech side, bunch of different folks, right?
Right.
But bootstrapping a company versus getting funding, those are two very different paths. And, you know, you talked to, I went to Vancouver because I wanted to get out of my network and I would fly once a month. That's where Ace Tech was based out of. And, you know, as I say, great program, but there's lots of different ways to do it. You know, Karen's had different journeys. I've had many different journeys to get there, but certainly from the perspective of, you don't necessarily, you have to be well capitalized. I think, you know, most folks would say that, but you don't necessarily have to take the traditional friends and family, angels, Series A, Series B to do that. There's a bunch of different ways and a bunch of different incubators to support that. A lot of good guys here that have done it, and even some of the work in Edmonton around what's happened with Startup Edmonton and some of the things. Lots of great resources.
Right. And that's another conversation that we'll have, you know, later on is Edmonton's got a really great technology startup environment. And I don't want to go down that road too far, but, you know, being one of the top five AI cities in the world is quite impressive. But again, whole other conversation and requires a ton of support. So are there red flags? I mean, you say when things break, that's a red flag for an entrepreneur. Is that just time to pivot, or is that a full on reevaluation stage?
I guess it depends on the red flag.
Sure.
You know, I think, and these are sort of, in some cases, sort of obvious answers, but I think your cash flow, managing your cash flow. You know, we had again, when I go back to our Commonwealth years, we had a really tough time because we were growing so fast and our receivables were not keeping up with the money that we were outlaying. So even though on paper things were looking pretty good, you know, our cash flow was not being well managed. And, you know, and we kind of had a typical bookkeeper that came in once a week. Like, you know, we just the financial discipline in the company, I think, wasn't there. And in hindsight, I think if I could go back, I would say right in the beginning, you know, really have good cash flow management and really, you know, produce a good set of financial statements every month. Like all those basic things, I think, are just really help you. But I think the other signs are more that you start to get extremely burnt out and your people are too stretched and you start to lose focus about what you're doing. I think it becomes you know, and it's over a sustained period of time. Like I would say, if you start to feel that way over 6 to 12 months, you really have to sort of stop and say, I need to get some perspective and figure out where we are and where we're going.
I mean, that's a really good answer, because I feel that many business people don't take that as a, you know, I'm stressed. I should be stressed. And they don't listen to themselves. Sorry, Dave, for cutting you off.
No, not the stuff. I just re-echoing that, you know, certainly with the current business I'm involved with now, it was, you know, finished a transition and started something, you know, started to build on something different. And with the introduction of COVID, that's changed everybody's world, right? Like, and for us, you know, being in the virtual voting space and helping out with helping organizations that can't meet face to face anymore, and they're just looking for answers. You know, certainly for us, that's, you know, we've been very fortunate. The timing's been very fortunate for our team, but we're going through exactly that. When your business grows 10x in a month, and you're trying, and what was pretty right-sized at the time, and then you're seeing what's breaking, what's not breaking, are you stressed, what do you pivot to, how do you change those models? It's, to me, that's the fun part of business, like the ability to get so much data in a short period of time and evaluate that, be nimble enough to respond to that, to really hone that model to say, this is what we're going to change to, and more importantly, to say, yeah, we didn't break. Man, we grew 9x last month and we didn't break. That's fantastic. And celebrating that with the team, because it's really the team that does that. So that's the very gratifying and a ton of fun.
Right.
I'll just share a story that's just coming to mind for me that, you know, I go back, I'm thinking about kind of reflecting back on lessons learned. You know, the other one for me is that one contract or one customer does not make you a $10 million business. And we had, you know, and I think a lot of people go through this. So, you know, we're growing our business and all of a sudden you get, you know, a real game changing contract. And it's like, we're in the game. This is big. And the lesson I learned in it is, you know, a game changing contract that's more than 20% or more of your business is really, you are a small company with a big contract. You are not an X company. And that was my biggest lesson, because when we went down that path, and all of a sudden we start building all the infrastructure, assuming the company is now at that scale, and that contract doesn't get renewed, and now you're in deep trouble. And so really understanding, I think, where your revenue is coming from and what is your baseline and how repeatable is it? And then making those decisions to put in infrastructure kind of in lockstep. You know, maybe you want to be a little out front, but I think if you get too far out front, you're really going to get into trouble. And I, you know, and we've been there. We've been to the edge and back.
I mean, that's a really good point. You know, having that one white whale is great. Yeah. As long as you can maintain that forever and ever. Amen. But, you know, things change and, you know, you really need to diversify your revenue stream.
Well, and it's about Matt. I think Karen brings up a fantastic point. It's really about that match, right? It's like you get too far in front of your skis, right? Like, are you building too much, but you don't have the cash flow to support it? Or are you reinvesting too much, you know, at the time, because you've got that, you know, as you term, Sean, the one white whale, say that fast 5 times. Hey, but certainly, you know, I had a very small altruism and it's something that stuck with me a long time. I used to play Monopoly with my uncle when I was a kid. We were out in the farm, we'd work hard all day. And then every night we'd play Monopoly and he'd always kick my butt at it. Cause I was always the guy that wanted the hotels and Park Place and Boardwalk. And I was always thinking, I wouldn't think about the cash flow to get me to Park Place or Boardwalk. Well, you know, business isn't, in some ways, not that different. If you invest to get to Park Place and Boardwalk all the time and you don't take care of the small stuff, you can get crushed. But if you don't invest to get to Park Place and you're continually taking the money out, you're not going to be able to be around in 5 years because other people will pass you by. So it's every year is a little bit different. You circulate a team back and get folks in. It's a really good piece of advice that Karen brings up.
Excellent. So, you know, with that, once you've achieved this weird, awkward phase, is that a time to start looking at selling? If you're not going to ride it out to the end, if you're not going to own it forever, is that a good time to look at selling, or is that probably premature?
If I knew the answer to that one, like with us, with divestiture opportunities, sometimes they come, you evaluate it. You know, for me, divestiture is always having a plan B, because the odds of actually consummating the deal can be very small. And right. You know, that's the biggest roller coaster, especially when we did the last one. It was a massive roller coaster in terms of doing that. But, you know, you might be looking at divestiture. You might be looking at acquisition to maintain your growth. You might be looking at partnerships for geographical relationships. There's a bunch of different things that you look at, and how does it fit within, you know, the broader strategy to be, you know, if you want to be the best in the world at something, or the best in your geography, or the best, you know, the best that you can be. It doesn't matter what your craft is. You know, I was talking with a guy, a former MLB guy yesterday, and it's like, you know, he congratulated us and some of the stuff that we had done. And I said, you know, I don't care if you're building software, or you're doing election stuff, or you're a baseball player, or you're West Kent, right? If you can say that you're trying to be the best of your business and you've established that craft and you've done it, that's a hat you can hold your hand on. And then those other opportunities will come for divestiture or growth or whatever it is. I'm a firm believer in that. But in terms of timing it, I'm not that smart.
Perfect. So go ahead. Sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, I'll add a couple of thoughts to that. I think, you know, to me, there's a real difference between selling your business for a strategic reason and selling your business because you're looking for an exit. And I think we had two failed acquisitions before we ultimately sold the company. And a couple lessons learned, you know, so one for me is sell your company at a time when you don't have to. So that you have lots of power and strength in the negotiation, and you can make really sound decisions. I think, you know, there were times when we were, you know, a little financially unstable and we thought this might be a good time to get rescued. Bad idea. It always went sideways because we could never get what we needed out of it. And I think the other thing for me, and this is maybe my own personal philosophy, is don't build a company to sell. Now that's, you know, so that's my personal philosophy, because I think, again, we got into that trap of trying to make decisions about what would somebody else want to buy. And I'm like, our goal is to build a great company. And let's keep our eye on the ball. And then, you know, we'll look for what are the appropriate acquisition or, you know, opportunities as we go down the road. But otherwise, you get really unnerved by, you know, where do we stand if we're trying to buy what, you know, build something that somebody else would buy.
And you know, the other point, it's really, you know, Karen Sage, she's got lots of good war stories and lots of good things on that side. You know, one of the toughest things that I learned, and, you know, I've been very fortunate to have some really good advisors all the way through some different things. And I like to do a lot myself too. I take pride in that. But that whole concept of being knowing how the game is played when you're going through that sale is really, really important. And the guys that are coming in to buy, this is not their first rodeo, using a Calgary term, right? Like, they've done it 100 different times and they know the buttons to push, especially if you're that owner manager that's not been through it 100 times. I was fortunate to have good advisors, but, you know, going through it yourself as a 22-year-old and then a 30-year-old and then an old geezer like me, those are very different kind of things, and they'll play on that. So you just make sure you surround yourself with some good people, you get a good accountant, get a good lawyer, have a long relationship with that, and then you'll make those good decisions, and people that you really, really trust to help you make those decisions, because they'll weigh, and it's a roller coaster. I'm sure Karen will echo that when she went through hers. It's
no,
like,
napkin deals. No napkin deals.
Stay away from the bar napkins.
Yeah.
And there's, we're putting together a future episode on So You Want to Go Public, and spoiler alert, it's a lot of, you know, it's not their first rodeo and you don't hold the cards type of thing. So that's a good segue into that type of thing. Well, I think what we've kind of discussed today is that there is no one way to do things. There is no one thing that you can lean upon or identify. It's just really an individual type of thing. And, you know, there are some things that entrepreneurs can do to make their lives easier or make things a little smoother. But you know, it's again, it's just very individual. You know, I'd like to give you guys, you know, a minute or two each and just kind of talk about what you're doing now, and, you know, have a little, forum. So, you know, Dave, why don't you go ahead?
Well, Election Buddy, you know, that's what I'm involved with today. And we've had some significant growth since COVID. Election Buddy is a simple to set up, high integrity, cloud-based voting platform that allows member-based organizations like professional associations, homeowners associations, unions, and universities to manage both remote elections and virtual meetings using our cloud-based platform. You can send notice, record the vote, tally the results, and share the winners, and do so at a what we think is a pretty competitive and pretty reasonable price.
Nice. I should put that forward to our condo board. We could use some voting there. Anyway, Karen, please.
Yeah. So I'm in a really unique place in my career. I think so. I'm building the next generation of a 65-year-old business, and so it has all sorts of interesting new startup challenges. Building the second generation. So we are really in the digital print and information management space, and we can print anything. And today, you know, in today's world, direct mail is having a complete resurgence. So we have a real hot spot in our business around developing personalized solutions for direct mail and doing some really creative and interesting things there. And also our signage business, you know, and interesting signage now is no longer just about a sign. It's really about creating, you know, great workspaces and maybe even your home now. So that business is all changing. Sean, one thing I just want to say, because I'm thinking of people that are listening to this that might be just starting out or just starting businesses. And I just feel like one thing I want to say is how rewarding, like as hard as it is, I think building businesses as an entrepreneur is the greatest job in the world. And, you know, I feel like right now, you know, entrepreneurialism is what's going to drive our economy. So I think this is a great topic, and not to be afraid of the challenges or the, you know, the awkward teenage years or whatever. You know, if you're committed and you persevere through it, there's so many rewards on the other side. It's so worth it.
Excellent. That's entirely why most people get into entrepreneurialism. It's truly not because they want to, you know, have a stable life.
That's for sure.
All right, Karen, Dave, it's been great. Thank you for joining us. You know, hopefully we can have you back sometime.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Nice to meet you, Karen.
You too.
We hope you've enjoyed the Technology Innovation and Growth Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or would just like more information, please feel free to reach out to us at podcast@tapintotech.com. If you have any questions for me, Sean Gange-Harris, my email is sgangeharris@tapintotech.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, and at www.tapintotech.com. Music provided today by www.bensound.com. Thank you for listening.